morning, you all. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. You'll also hear Mel, Kilo 2 Kilo Echo Yankee. Mel and Dick try to moderate this enthusiastic crowd that gathers to discuss their favorite subject, ham radio. There was a New York City marathon today. We should be hearing a little bit about that. Some exciting things are going on in space, and maybe Paul at WS2N will be telling us about that. If you want to really see an interesting piece of hardware that's going to be put up next February, it's called the Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer. I'll be discussing that a little bit. A person signs into the technical net by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. A typical sign-in would sound like this, KC2RFN, Alan, and yes. And Alan is quite often signing in these days. We also automatically have signed in both John and Wesley, KC2WGB and N2XJN. They're running a very extensive experiment in studying magnetics lately, and I've got something to report to them along those lines. I've discovered an interesting magnetic material. So, for those who would like to sign in because they do have a question or a comment, please give me your call letters, name, and the word yes at this time, K2RIW.
Yes, KC2LTY, Richie, yes.
AC2AZ, Bob, yes. Okay, we've got Rich, and we've got Bob. Anyone else?
Evening, K2KEY.
Very fine, Mel. Mel, were you at mile marker number 4 or something like that in Brooklyn?
I was. Real great race, boy. A lot of people in GF. I think a lot more than previous years. I think this may be, maybe wind up the biggest. And weather was great. A little cool in the morning as it started out. But by noontime, it was really pleasant. Sun shining, wind wasn't too bad. So, nice time was had by all.
Yeah, my issue of Newsday, I may have the numbers wrong, but I think they claimed that 54,000 people made application for the New York City Marathon. I'm not sure that all of them were accepted. And they claim it is the largest event of its time, of its kind, worldwide. I wonder if you saw Mr. Pena, the man from Chile, go by. Were you at your post when Mr. Pena went by? Mel, go ahead.
Yeah, especially he came to an area that is predominantly Spanish where I am. So you can well imagine there were a lot of waving of the Chilean flags and yelling in Spanish to him. And so he was like a movie star, waving his arms and shaking hands and all. And, but he couldn't stop for autographing anything. But quite a sight to see him in real, Dick, over.
Was I correct in assuming, from what I saw on television, that there were two race officials in yellow uniforms walking alongside of him, running alongside of him? Is that what you saw also?
Yeah, he seemed to have a little entourage around him. I think a couple of the race officials, plus I think a couple other people, possibly, you know, to help him translate or to protect him in just case, you know, some nonsense. You know, we always worry with the last marathon in the last few years that there shouldn't be any kind of incident that would give it a black eye over.
Sounds good. We'll be hearing a little bit more about that later. Okay, one last call. We've got John, Rich, and Bob signed in. Anyone else with a question or a comment, give me your call letters, your name, and the word yes at this time. K2RIW in the TechNet. Okay, we've got more than enough to get started. I think Wesley might be out of town, so I'm going to go over to John first. And John, one of the things that I purchased this week, which is available on eBay from a number of places, I think I bought it from Amazon, I guess I bought it from, or eBay, I'm not sure which. It's something called magnetic display material. It's a greenish sheet of plastic, and I bought the one that's 4 inches by 6 inches. And you bring a magnet of north polarity, I think it is, near the material, and it turns a darker green. Bring the south pole of a magnet near it, and it turns a lighter green. Hold the side of a magnet near it, and by the colorations you get, you can actually visualize the magnetic field. It's a little bit more convenient than using iron filings as a way of displaying where the magnetic field is going. So I wonder if you've heard about this magnetic display material, magnetic visualizing material. I guess it's got a lot of different names. The 4x6-inch piece of it was $6 and change, as I remember. I paid about as much for postage as I did for the material itself. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the tech net. I wonder if you got that email I mailed you.
Good evening, Dick. No. Wow, that sounds like a great material for exactly what I'm working on, especially for the cryogenics. That makes it a lot simpler. This evening, I have two questions. I'd like to save the second one for after Mel's time, because I know we got to get those guys off early. And my first one's going to be concerned with Doppler. Is that all right with you?
That's a good suggestion. Okay, yeah. Very kind for the rest of the crew. So go ahead and ask your question about Doppler. I've worked with Doppler radars quite a bit. And also, by way of that email I mailed you, I think we were talking about using a power divider and putting some of the power toward your specimen and some of it toward a feed horn. I suddenly realized that if you put all of your RF power toward the feed horn and just adjust the spacing between your specimen and the feed horn, you can adjust anything from, let's say, 700 watts going to the specimen all the way down to zero just by adjusting the length. So I was trying to give you some information along those lines. KC2WGB, go ahead with your first question on Doppler. K2LIW in the tech net.
Okay, Dick. If we draw a line on a piece of paper, say 10 inches long, and at each end of that line we were to put a transmitter, both of them identical, same propagation factors, antennas, everything being equal, and we'll say that's a mile apart. You got that picture?
I've got the picture, and I've studied problems a little bit like this. I wonder how close you're going to get to one that I've already studied. Go ahead.
Okay. Now, out of this, we'll create an equilateral triangle going up the same distance from each end to an apex. That is where the Doppler unit will be taking its readings. Got that so far?
Yes, I do. And the so-called Doppler unit, is it moving with reference to the two transmitters?
Negative. Everything is stationary right now. What I'm going to ask, there seems to be a Ramsey unit out there, which Glenn is very familiar with. A lot of people are using it. And it's just an LED indicator. But my question is, if we turn on that Doppler with both transmitters transmitting identical information, will we get two indications on the Doppler LED display, or will we get a center indication sort of in the middle of that baseline? How would that work?
Yeah, now there's a lot of variations here. When you say Doppler, you're now talking about a Doppler scanner. Doppler scanner is really a chunk of electronics, usually with four antennas, six antennas, eight antennas, and there are switching devices on the antennas as it goes into the so-called Doppler scanner receiver network. Now, electronically, you turn on each one of those antennas in sequence. If I take a ridiculous example of six antennas, I could have one at the 12 o'clock, 3 o'clock, 6 o'clock, 9 o'clock. Would that be 1, 2, 3, 4? That would only be 4. But you know what I mean. 2 o'clock, 4 o'clock, 6 o'clock, so on. We can eventually get an arrangement of antennas in a circle, and by turning them on in sequence, when there's normally one emitter out there, what you're doing electronically is the equivalent of having a ground plane antenna on the perimeter of a turntable. If I could turn a turntable fast enough, it would be a beautiful Doppler scanner where, let's assume now that my emitter is to the north, and therefore as my antenna on the turntable rotates, as it comes to the 9 o'clock position, it will be with maximum velocity approaching the antenna that's to the north. At the 12 o'clock position, it will be moving parallel to the signal coming from the north, and it'll be midway between the highest and the lowest. And then at 3 o'clock, your clockwise rotating antenna on this turntable would be receding from the transmitter, therefore it would see the lowest frequency. So you would see the highest frequency, 9 o'clock, zero offset frequency at 12 o'clock and 6 o'clock, and maximum decrease in frequency at 3 o'clock. If you could rotate a single antenna rapidly enough, that arrangement I just described would work like a charm. But there's a catch.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
The catch is, in order to get enough Doppler at 2 meters, that would work, with the turntable, it would work like a charm at the, let me pick a number, 24 gigahertz. But at 144 megacycles, to get enough frequency shift of Doppler, you'd be moving the antenna at close to the speed of sound or beyond. Just the mechanical rotation characteristics would be very difficult. So what they've done instead is to electronically rotate the antenna by having multiple antennas in sort of a circle, and you select the antennas in sequence. Now what the electronics is supposed to do is to look for the quasi-sine wave of Doppler shifting. In other words, it compares the frequency that is the center frequency versus the instantaneous frequency from the moving antenna, and it recognizes where the highest frequency exists, where the lowest frequency exists as it switches through the antennas, and the logic makes a decision as to where's the highest, where's the lowest, where's the medium frequency, and it selects the appropriate light-emitting diode on your display to tell you where the signal is coming from. If you've got more than one emitter, you're now going to get a much more complicated waveform for two reasons. One is because of the Doppler effect itself. The moving antenna, as it moves toward transmitter number one, it sees a higher frequency from transmitter number one. And as it moves more toward transmitter number two, it'll see a higher frequency from that signal transmitter. In reality, when you've got two separate transmitters, in the real world, when they're two, when they're 10 miles apart in your example, let me drop. You've got another very complicated thing going on, and that is, unless you've taken some extremely careful, compensating moves, those two transmitters will never be on exactly the same frequency. One's always going to be a little bit higher than the other. Therefore, you've got a beat note between the two transmitters, particularly if one of the, if each of the transmitters also have a PL tone on them where they're moving up and down, and the PL tone, there's a different magnitude of PL tone of transmitter 1 and 2, a different phase angle of the PL tone, even if they're on the exact same frequency of PL tone. So you've got PL tones that are different. You've got frequencies moving up and down because of the PL tone, even if there is no voice modulation on either transmitter. And the basic carrier frequency of each transmitter is slightly different. So therefore, you've got a very complicated waveform of two transmitters beating against each other. The amplitude is going to be jumping up and down pretty violently at the rate of the difference in frequencies. And because of the PL tones, all kinds of nasty things are going to happen. What you're really asking now is, would a normal Doppler scan circuit of normal design be able to figure out what's going on? I think the answer is almost no. I think you're going to get random lightings of the light-emitting diodes indicating the apparent direction of arrival until you make much more complex circuitry in your Doppler scan direction-finding receiver. So I think in that particular scenario, in the real world of FM transmitters with PL tones, I'm reasonably sure you're not going to get a reasonable answer out of it. And you can see some of the reasons why, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Excellent response, Dick. Thank you very much. Also, I was wondering, if we didn't have a PL and no audio, just work with carriers, and let's say they were locked, satellite frequency locked, what do you think the effect would be there?
Okay. I've worked on a military system where you intentionally transmit the exact same frequency from the two wingtips of an airplane. Now, this is a kind of a radar jamming system where if you can have a transmitter on the left-hand wingtip and the transmitter on the right-hand wingtip, both coming from the exact same, the transmitting antenna coming from the exact same transmitter, and if you're careful enough to adjust the phase shift between those two signal emitters, you are really making a phased array The phased array is a kind of an interferometer. You've got multiple wavelengths between the two transmitters. Therefore, even if they're on the exact same frequency, you're going to be generating a whole lot of fingers in space. When I say fingers, I mean fingers of amplitude versus azimuth from, in my example, the center of the airplane. All of these fingers in space could electronically be waved back and forth by just doing a simple phase shift of the signal you send to the left-hand antenna versus the right-hand wingtip antenna. And if you're smart enough to generate a null in the pattern, in other words, the space between the two fingers in space falls right on the center of the antenna of the radar system you're jamming, the net result is the left-hand side of the antenna, that's the victim, gets positive phase signal, the right-hand side gets negative phase signal, and the direction-finding electronics that's on the radar system, the so-called monopulse direction-finding radar system, becomes extremely confused if you succeed in doing that. So even if you've got the exact same frequency, you've now got to worry about what is the difference in mileage between the two emitting sites and the receiving site, what's the phase shift between the two. Therefore, those multiple fingers in space, they are making a very complicated transmitting They're making a very complicated transmitting pattern. And any normal direction-finding system, like the monopulse radar system in my example, versus the doppelscan that you're using, again, the chances of coming up with a good direction of arrival without adding some extra sophistication of the circuitry, I don't think it's proper. I don't think it's likely. But it's going to take some more experiments. Also, I'm going to think about it some more because you've now got a fairly unique situation here. Identical frequency, fixed in phase, some particular phase, two different locations, both transmitting simultaneously, no PL tone, no other modulation. What will the doppelscanner indicate? I'm reasonably sure it's not going to indicate the right answer, and will it indicate an answer that you can interpret, is what I think you're really asking. That's a toughie, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Excellent, Dick. No, I understand the complexities. I'm just trying to see what the estimated result would be. But that's a great answer, and it's taken me, I can skip a few pages now. So after Mel, if you'll come back to me, I'll have another question, a little more involved in this one, but thank you for the time.
More involved in that one, that's scary. We're getting pretty deep here as it is. Just to give you an example, there is a communication system that I'm aware of where one single transmitter is being picked up on two locations simultaneously, and the two locations where the single transmitter is being picked up are, I think they're a fraction of a mile apart, and those two signals are being mixed together because if either one has a stronger signal, you want the receiver to respond to it. And so the exact same transmitter is picked up by two antennas, and there's a spacing between the two antennas, and the signals are brought down to a common point where they're combined. Very innocent sounding system. But because there is a PL tone on the transmitter, and because there's a mile or so of separation between the two receiving sites before the signals become combined, the net result is that you've got a different path length between the transmitter and the two separate receiving sites. Therefore, as far as the PL tone is concerned, which is FM modulating the transmitter, moving it up and down in frequency, the two separate sites are seeing different phase angles of the modulation. That really means that when it's received at site number one, at the first instant of time, it might be the positive peak of the PL tone is coming in there, at the same time that almost the negative peak of the PL tone is getting to the second site. The positive peak of the PL tone is moving the frequency up, the negative peak is moving it down. The two frequencies are being combined, but there's a frequency offset between the two, even though it's a common transmitter. There's a frequency offset because of the timing of the PL tone that's doing FM modulating. And therefore, those two signals, when they get combined at the common receiving site, Because of the frequency offset.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
It gives you what they call a growling sound. There's always a frequency offset between the two. At one distant time, the left-hand antenna is seeing the higher peak of the PL tone, and the right-hand antenna is seeing the lower, and half a cycle of PL tone later, it's the other way around. So these two tones are waving back and forth in a non-synchronous manner, up and down in frequency. Therefore, they're beating against each other, and even though it's a good FM receiver with a good limiter network before the discriminator, and you would think it would take out all of the amplitude modulation of the beat note, it doesn't succeed in doing that, and you hear this very annoying growling sound in that particular system. So more than one transmitter received at a common site. There's a lot more to it that first meets the eye, as you can see, John. Okay, Rich was next, K2 Lima Tango Yankee. What would you like to talk about tonight, Rich? K2RIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
I had a ICOM 2100 and I had a power supply. I don't remember the name of it. And it went bad. Voltage went from 13.8 to 32 volts. Power supply hit an automatic timer. That's not the fucking radio. Shut itself off after X amount of time. And it burned up. Can the radio be repaired or is it junk?
When you bring a radio like that, Rich, to somebody like, by the way, I called you K2, I think it's KC2, LTY. When you bring a radio like that to somebody like Andy, to B2CDL, I think, I'm guessing only 3% of the time does he consider it a complete waste. Almost everything is fixable. You may have all kinds of smoke and smells and everything else because a particular component burned up in a power supply inside of a unit. And it's very easy to say that, hey, this is a loser. Well, after you clean it out, you may discover that you burned up a particular diode rectifier network or a filter capacitor. And rarely do you have one component failing and then it wipes out 40 other components. Yeah, it's possible. It's possible when you lose a voltage regulator, and in some really ridiculous cases, an extremely high voltage is applied to all the rest of the circuitry, and it can do quite a bit of damage. That's a rare case. But with the exception of something like that, I think there's a 95% chance it's repairable as I see it, Rich. So I would wave it under Andy's nose and let him make a declaration for you. And that way you'll know more than if you sent it back to the factory. The factory will, of course, charge you a whole lot of money to do the analysis and or the repair. And I think you're going to get a lot more bang for the dollar if you bring it to one of Andy's so-called tune-up clinics, or just walk it over to his house after calling him on the phone first and getting his permission. You walk it over to his house, take the cover off, let him look at it under his magnifying glass, and I think there's a 90-some-odd% chance you're going to get good news. Almost everything is repairable, though, Rich. KC2LTY, K2RAW in the TechNet, to a guy that's crafty enough.
Yeah, copy that, Dick. Yeah. Power supply, I assume it's history, but, the radio, they're too cheap to send to the manufacturer to be repaired. Copy that. Thank you. You answered my question.
Yeah, I think you live in Mineola, and for you to go all the way over to Hempstead, West Hempstead, I think it is where he lives, it's not a long trip. Call him on the phone, get his permission, and come back and tell us what you find out. I think there's a medium good chance you're going to hear good news, Rich. Next person who signed in was...
comment, Kate, KEY.
Go ahead, Mel, with your comment.
Okay, sometimes you look on some of these nets that review, you know, different problems with pieces of equipment. And if it was a prevalent thing with the number of pieces, they will tell you what is involved. You've got to look online for that particular piece of equipment and see what other hams have experienced. And many times they give you the answer. They'll say, well, you know, you'll just see the problem and how they described it. You say, gee, same problem. And, here's the fix. Over.
Another good suggestion. So in other words, what's the easiest way to find one of those nets where people gather information? Once he knows that it's a Kenwood or an ICOM, is there a way that he can find out the email address for the ICOM repair net, so to speak? What's the easiest way to find that one, though? Mel, go ahead.
I believe they got a thing called EHAM. EHAM, Dick. I believe that's what it's referred to. And then they can sort of put you on the right path, but I believe that the term is EHAM, over.
Sounds good. In other words, if he Googles the word EHAM, he's going to find that group of people who have gathered, I guess, all of these sites that represent Kenwood, ICOM, Yaesu, and so on. Sounds good. So, in case you have trouble doing that, Rich, come back and ask us the question again. We'll give you even more guidance if need be. The next person who signed in was Bob. And boy, am I terrible. I'm not recognizing your call letters each time I hear them, Bob. Alpha Charlie 2 Alpha Zulu is one of the substantial members of the ASLI group, Astronomical Society of Long Island, of which I was a member for a while, and Bob was one of the substantial members. He's been involved in the past in very low light level cameras. I mean, some of these modern day charge couple device cameras, when you connect them to the eyepiece of your telescope, my goodness, do you get the astrophotography, among other kinds of photography, even terrestrial photography if you want to. You can see in the dark, if you know what I mean. That can give you all kinds of possibilities. Bob hasn't done that, but I know I've thought about it, and I've tried to talk him into it from time to time. And as I've just recently saw, let me drop for a second. I went and looked at what NASA is doing with reference to the Discovery that was supposed to be launched, and it got scrubbed. But not Discovery, but the very next launch in February, the Atlantis, is going to be bringing up 7.5 tons of space hardware, which is called the AMZ, the Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer. If you go to the right website, and there's an old one and a new one, where they decided to go from the cryogenic magnet to the regular magnet, but 7.5 tons of instrument that's going to be mounted on one of the main bars of the International Space Station. And this is going to be an extremely high power cosmic ray detector type telescope. Every time you look for anything in space, no matter how high your instrumentation goes in brightness and strength of signal or gamma ray burst or whatever, there's always going to be something that saturates your equipment. Those cosmic rays in space at times are, I think the number was 10,000 or 100,000 times more powerful than the strongest particle accelerator output that we can create from the LHC, I think it is, this new machine in CERN, Switzerland, where when they test this AMZ in front of that, they're just looking at the low end of its scale, if you know what I mean. So by way of this AMZ piece of hardware that's going to go up next February, in theory, they're going to be looking for dark matter, negative matter. Turns out that all the theories of where does all the stuff in the space come from during the Big Bang, there should have been an equal amount of positive matter and negative matter. And where's all the negative matter? And so did it go to some other place? Did it get canceled by some matter? So this AMZ is going to be looking for that, among other things.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
So this Dr. Ting, who is a Nobel laureate who works for MIT, is the chief investigator of this project. The project is funded by 16 separate countries, and 145 separate institutions are building various portions of this piece of hardware. Very fancy piece of hardware. So if you haven't seen that one, I hadn't heard about it until I found that website yesterday and started reading it. I said, wow. Various people are predicting that whenever you put up something that's looking at a brand new portion of the spectrum in power output or frequency range, and the highest frequency range anybody knows about is cosmic rays. And we've had no real cosmic ray telescope in space, so to speak, above the atmosphere. So there's a high probability it's going to find things that are very unpredicted. I know I've got you off subject of what you'd like to talk about, Bob, but you're a space enthusiast, I thought I'd throw that in. AC2 Alpha Zulu, K2 RIW in the TechNet. You got it, Bob.
Big Bang. KC2, Zulu Godzilla listening.
We'll find out about that. You got it, Bob.
Thanks, Dick. Yeah, I'm no longer a member of that club, but I'll fill you in that next time you see you at an IEEE meeting. But, yeah, I do have an image intensifier, and I have aimed it up at the sky. And it's interesting. You think it'd be wonderful, but from what I found, you really, really need a fast lens to keep the signal-to-noise ratio at a decent place. And I think it's okay for the eye, but I don't think it really works well for photography. There's too much noise in the background, and it's just going to fill in a CCD sensor. But that's been my experience so far. I haven't done too much of it other than just scanning the field, so to speak, with the image intensifier to see what everybody's doing at night. Kind of interesting to play with. But anyway, my question, let me drop for a second. Okay, my question is, Dick, has anybody had any experience or any luck with simulating a VSWR bridge in SPICE, in PSPICE? I tried playing with it. I know Bird has a little dissertation on it. It's basically, a sampling line, and at one end of the line, the capacitive coupling cancels the inductive coupling. At the other end of the line, they add together. And I kind of tried simulating this, and I just don't know if PSPICE is designed to handle reflections. It certainly does show, it does have transmission lines. It certainly does show reflections from an open or shorter termination or something other than 50 ohms. But I'm not quite sure I'm getting this SWR bridge thing working properly. I don't know. Has anybody ever done it with lumped elements versus a complete model?
Now, I guarantee Mel's going to be chiming in on this one. There was an article in QEX magazine, I'm going to make a guess, 4 or 5 years ago, in which a guy did something very similar to what you're discussing, Bob. He had 3 or 4 positions along a coaxial cable in which he did voltage and phase sampling. And by looking at the phase angle difference between those samples, he had analog to digital converters, whether it sequenced between the 4 positions or whether they were continuously operating, I'm not sure. But as I said, there was this article in QEX, and it was a sampling type standing wave ratio, digital type standing wave ratio meter. I now know with enough of those search words on, if you're an ARRL member and you go to the archives, and QEX is archived, I'm reasonably sure you're going to find it. Let's see if Mel remembers that article. Somebody has worked out all the details, if you know what I mean. K2KEY, I wonder if you remember that article, Mel. You're a Visual main from way back, so I bet you did. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, Roger, Dick. Yeah, this is K2KEY. Very interesting concept. I meant to bring it up sometime. You know, every so often something pops in my head, from one of the old articles, either QEX or ham radio and all that is of interest. And I started to try to duplicate, because that device is very intriguing. I thought possibly I could include it in that super antenna tuner that I built with the servo motors in it to automatically, tune by means of, instead of just relays, actually tuned condensers and inductors with motors. And I had a success with that tuner. It's being used. It does give us a little twerking here and there every so often that starts to hunt and drive you crazy for some reason. But I wanted to incorporate that into it. But for some reason, I could never get the doggone thing, because maybe I could not see, maybe at that time the right opponent, so I maybe put it by the way, but I haven't got to go.
I'm going to make a couple of guesses on this one, Mel. When it comes to building the right kind of a sampling head in order to sample voltage and or phase at an RF frequency, there's a fair amount of art and science required to do it correctly. It's one of these situations where on paper it looks simple, When you actually carry it out, it's a little bit of a minefield. There's five ways you can go wrong, and only one way you can do it right so that it gives the right kind of an answer. That's part of what's going on. To make the thing broadband enough to cover 80, 40, 20, 15, and 10 meters, for instance, there's a whole bunch of difficulties there, depending on how you choose the sampling points. Can you choose sampling points that are not going to give you ambiguities or residuals or artifacts or whatever? I'm going to send a couple of other words to you, Bob. Let me drop for a minute. I work with a vector network analyzer every day of my life for the last 8 years because I'm doing antenna design every day of my life with one of those instruments, a Rohde & Schwarz, beautiful instrument. I guess the darn thing cost $40,000 or $50,000. Thank goodness somebody else supplied it. What a vector network analyzer is, it's doing almost exactly what you're describing. It takes samples and figures out what's the phase angle and what's the magnitude. The network analyzer, though, operates with a directional coupler. You're trying to even synthesize the directional coupler. And there is some merit in just really building in real hardware the directional coupler and then calibrating it. That's what the vector network analyzer does. A modern-day vector network analyzer has almost no ambiguity to it. It's got a fairly ordinary, yucky performance directional coupler in it. It's got a directional coupler looking forward and a directional coupler looking backwards on both port number one and port number two. And when I say yucky, I mean because the directional coupler is trying to cover such an extremely wide frequency range, the particular vector network analyzer I'm using, I guess, goes down to a fraction of a megacycle and up to 8,000 megacycles. Let me drop. And it's almost impossible to build a good directional coupler across that number of octaves. However, even if you build the directional coupler favoring, let me pick a number, the 5 gigahertz region, and you're using it from 8 gigahertz above the frequency where it's optimized, and you're using it many, many octaves lower in frequency, all the way down to a fraction of 1 megacycle, where it was optimized for 5 gigahertz. It turns out a directional coupler in its coupling coefficient falls off at 60 beats per octave as you go down in frequency in a very predictable manner. S9 to 20 over, Mobile from MyQTH. How about it yours, Glenn? Mel, were you hearing about the input?
Barely, but 245 degrees from my spot. Exactly, but barely.
Okay, other people on frequency who are hearing the input, give me a call letters right now.
B, heard him at 3.5 to 7.5.
Who was that? Very fine, Eric. John, John, you told us how strong it was at your location. Could that information again, John?
In the beginning, he was 3.5 to 7.5, but near the end, he went all the way up to S20.
I can tell he was within a mile or two of the repeater site itself. I can tell that by the amount of tone I hear when I beat against him with my transmitter, if you know what I mean. So I think you're pretty sure he's going down the parkway right in front of the repeater. Okay. Hey, what else was that? Any other signal strength reports you want to give us? Give me a couple of... beginning of the repeater site itself. That gives us a rather small a circle to search, if you know what I mean.
K2RWK, good guy. Use the Eastern input, it's all you want.
Eric recommends that I use the Eastern input. It's a little bit more difficult for me to hear my own voice coming back with a delay. But once I get beyond that, I should be able to continue. So as I was saying, Bob, and Bob was hearing him also in Huntington, I would recommend using a real directional coupler and calibrate. That's what the vector network analyzer does. When you're going through the cal procedure, it literally is calibrating the amplitude and phase response of its medium performance directional couplers. That's the way they do it, the pros, so to speak. And so I think that's an easier approach than trying to sample voltage and phase at various points along a line and making a judgment on that one. That's a very tough way to go. So the difficulty that Mel ran into, again, is confirmation that's a difficult way to go. So if we hop over to the way the pros do it, I think you'll get more for your money, if you know what I mean. I wonder if you have the ability to go to the Eastern input, in other words, 147.375 for receive and 975 for transmit with the same PL tone. AC2, AZ, come back on either frequency that you would desire. K2LIW in the TechNet.
You can also clear in by echo on
AC2 QAQ.
Go ahead, Glenn.
And Dick, I just wanted to report, I was getting him on 250, the jammer, at about an estimate. North of west of me, so that kind of puts them a little bit east of the repeater. K2RIWKC2QIQ.
Yeah, I'm hearing three conversations at once. Bob has talked to me on the 146.25, and I heard everything he said. Also, Eric is saying that we can get through by way of both the western input, which is what I'm on right now, but correction, the eastern input, 147.375, as well as by Echo Link. And Glenn, I know you want to make a report, and so we'll pick you up in a second. And yes, by way of PSPICE, you're trying to really sample various spots along the line to make a judgment as to which way the signal is flowing and how strong it's flowing in those two directions. And it's a fairly difficult problem. When you read that article that's in QEX, it'll give you some hint as to how difficult it is, Bob. And the fact that Mel made a serious attempt to doing it and wasn't successful on the first attempt, again, is pretty strong confirmation. So give me a couple of words, Bob, as to what you asked PSPICE to do. In other words, if I understand correctly, you probably were making a model of a situation where you chose half wave, quarter wave, or whatever, spacing along the line, and sampled the voltage and or phase and try to figure out what was going on by way of PSPICE. Is that approximately what you were doing, Bob? AC2AZ, K2RIW on the TechNet. Although Bird gave an explanation as to how their study, among other books, Hall and Howe's book on strip line techniques, you'll discover that you get directivity from a coupler. In other words, it can sense the difference between the forward flowing signal and the reverse flowing signal, if and only if it has the right combination of what's called Z-odd and Z-even. Just adding coupling capacitors and an inductor is not enough. There's got to be, on the coupled line, there's got to be both magnetic coupling to the main line as well as capacitive coupling to the main line. And the ratio between those has to be just right to cancel the signal in one direction and aid the signal in the other direction. And the way that is explained theoretically is called what's called Z-odd and Z-even. In other words, you've got a main line and a directional line that are usually side by side in a directional coupler. And when you feed a in-phase signal to both lines and measure the impedance, that's called Z-even. If you put differential signals between the two lines and measure the impedance, that's called Z-odd. There is a very specific ratio between Z-odd and Z-even that is required in order to derive directivity. I wonder if that makes some sense, Bob. AZ2AZ, I'll be listening to you on the input on 146.25, the same way you transmitted.
Go back to normal, then.
K2RW in the section.
Yeah, that ratio is exactly what I'm looking for. I knew the combination. I knew I couldn't just put some capacitive coupling. I know the capacitive coupling on one hand has to cancel the inductive current, and on the other end it's got to add to it. So I knew there was a ratio. I was just wondering if anybody has had any luck on finding that combination and getting it to work right. I guess that's why those bird elements are so expensive, right?
Once you understand the theory of operation, you'd be amazed how simple it is, Bob. When you have the right Z-odd and Z-even combination, and as I said, it is explained in Harlan Howe's book, H-O-W-E, a book called Strip Line Techniques. That was published way in the late 60s, early 70s, on the first edition. It's got two or three more editions. And I guarantee if we now Google with Wikipedia, directional coupler, directivity, Z-odd, Z-even, you Google those various combinations, you're going to find 10 articles explaining where directivity comes from. Directivity, as I said, is the right ratio of Z-odd, Z-even. You've got to have the right magnetic coupling between the two lines and capacitive coupling between the two lines. At first, it sounds very difficult. Believe it or not, the average amateur, let me drop, on the output of any transmitter that we ever generate, we can easily put a directional coupler. Your main piece of coax cable coming out of your Pi network or whatever of the transmitter goes to a type N or UHF connector on the output of the box. Inside of the box, you put a parallel little piece of wire. Call it a gimmick coupling coil if you like. It's just a piece of wire that a half inch, lies parallel to the unshielded center conductor coming from the transmitter going to the output connector, the UHF, type N, whatever. You just put a parallel piece of wire a half inch long. If on one side of that you've got a diode network which is rectifying the RF energy that sniffer picks up, and if you put on the far side just the right value of resistor, it's going to take some experimentation or it's going to take some calculations, you put the right load resistor on the far side, you'd be amazed how easy it is at one frequency at a time, to develop 20 or so, maybe even 30 decibels of directivity. You'd be amazed how easy it is. Not as exotic as you think. The capacitive coupling and the inductive coupling is automatic once you've chosen a half-inch chunk of line that's lying parallel to your output center conductor. But by properly terminating that, you can make it into a directional coupler. You can go one step beyond that. Let me drop. With some switching network or putting two of those lines side by side, you can make a dual directional coupler out of it. Making directivity just by choosing the right termination, which usually is a resistor, and it might require a little bit of reactance also, will force directivity. You'd be amazed how easy it is once you understand the principle. If you don't understand the principle, it can be an awful lot of experimentation that at first doesn't look like it's working. So building a directional coupler into the output of any network that you own is a lot easier than you think once you get the right principle. By studying the standing wave ratio bridges that are in the antenna book, for instance, will lead you to believe that it's a lot more complicated than it really is. And the reason that they're more complicated is because they want that network to work over multiple octaves, all of the ham bands at once, and to operate in a calibrated manner. If your transmitter that you're putting this directional coupler on is only working on one frequency, and you're willing to do your own calibrating, it can be done a lot easier. I know I haven't given you enough information to tell you exactly how to do it yet, but I guarantee there is a relatively simple solution once we dig a little bit deeper, Bob.
NY2H disconnected.
NY2H disconnected. Okay. Bob, AC2AZ, K2RIW in the TechNet. Very fine, Bob. I'm hearing you very well on the input. No one else is hearing you because we think your PL tone has been turned off. So what you were saying was not coming through. I know you tried a 60-ohm resistor, and there's nothing magic about the resistor being 60 ohms. Depending on the way your particular directional coupler is laid out, how close, how long, how thick is the wire, and whatever, it might require a 320-ohm resistor, or it might require a 10-ohm resistor. There's nothing magic about just because the main straight-through line is a 50-ohm line. Doesn't mean that the directional coupler line has to be a 50-ohm line or something close to it. You can make the directional coupler line a 300-ohm line and still have all the right directivity with the 300-ohm and maybe a little bit of reactant as a termination. So you've got more freedom than you know about once you understand the principle of operation of where directivity is coming from. Don't give up. I know it's a little bit hairy in the beginning and it seems kind of crazy, but once you understand the principle of operation, you'll be amazing how easy one frequency at a time building a reasonably high directivity coupler is possible. Are you trying to do this on one frequency at a time, Bob, or would you like this thing to work broadband? If you're looking for a broadband solution, I'll admit that it's going to get three times more difficult. AC2AZ, make sure your PL is turned on, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, sorry about that. Every time I turn the frequency knob on this thing, go back to 850, the tone goes off and duplex goes off, everything goes off on this radio. Anyway, I'm not trying to build one. I'm quite happy with my elements here and buying a commercial watt meter, and I've got a bunch of directional couplers. So I'm not interested in building one. I'm just interested in simulating one. Back to you, AC2AZ.
I have no idea how he can experiment one with one Dick.
Yeah, but be careful here, Mel. He doesn't want to build it. He wants to experiment with it. In order for the piece-by-piece modeling program that he's using to come up with the right answer, there must be a combination of transformer action between the straight-through line and the coupled line. There must be transformer action. It's not just that the coupled line has a kind of series inductance and that the coupled line has a certain kind of characteristic impedance. That's not enough for the model to give you the right answer. There's got to be a given amount of coupling coefficient transformer action. What would you call it now? Call it the magnetic coupling coefficient between the straight-through line and the coupled line, as well as the right amount of distributed capacitance, which can be made as lump capacitors at the end. But there's got to be capacitance between the lines, and there's got to be magnetic coupling of a transformer nature. In other words, the magnetic coupling of the signal flowing down the main line must produce a signal on the coupled line that is opposite on polarity on the two ends of that line, whereas the capacitive coupling between the two lines must produce a signal on the coupled line that is equal in polarity on the two ends of the coupled line. So in other words, the magnetic coupling must be odd. The capacitive coupling must be even onto the coupled line in order to derive directivity. I wonder if that made some sense, Bob. AC2AZ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I understand that concept. Just trying to find those right values, and you know, I'm not quite sure if modeling those wires, that little transmission line section, modeling it as a transformer is the right way to do it. There are transmission line sections in that program. What I decided to use as a transformer, primary and two secondaries, for both forward and reverse, and messed with those caps and stuff. I just could not get it to do something properly. So I will keep plugging at it until I find some solution to this thing. But it's dogging me. But it's just another thing to play with, you know? AC2AZ.
In order for PSPICE to model this, I think it must have the ability to model shielded twin lead, a directional coupler of the usual construction in a coaxial structure, is really shielded twin lead. It's not a single coax cable. It's not two coax cables side by side. It's shielded twin lead. The two center conductors must be unshielded from each other, even though both are shielded from the outside world. Does PSPICE have a subroutine that's capable of modeling that kind of a structure, Bob? Go ahead.
It has a generic transmission line, both a lossless and a lossy. Lossy, you have to provide your own model. They just really give you the symbol. But the lossless one looks symmetrical, meaning there's a top half, bottom half. On each end, there's two connections. For coax lines, that's typically grounded the lower half on each end, and that's worked through the transmission line, and the delays are correct. You can change the impedance, and that seems to work right. And for step functions, you know, when you put a step function in, you can see the reflected wave coming back and adding to the source or subtracting to the source, depending whether the impedance is high or low, higher or lower than the 50 ohm. So that works as a model transmission line, but I have not. I guess you could use it as a twin lead. I don't see any reason why not. Maybe I will use a section of that as a coupler. Instead of trying to use a transformer model, maybe I'll use that transmission line model and use half of that and try and bring that out, and maybe that'll do something for me.
Next, take the KY.
Yeah, hold on a minute, Mel. I'm going to back.